Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we hope you are staying safe and warm as this springish winter storm bothers us for just a bit. And we hope you'll enjoy Main Street today. And in the second half of today's show, we'll hear an excerpt from the Living on Earth series about the upcoming solar eclipse. Just what did our ancestors do when, all of a sudden, their communities were in the dark unexpectedly? But first, we open our show with a conversation with Brad Hawk. He's the executive director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, and he was appointed by Governor Doug Burgum and was very open about many topics from jobs to healthcare to racism, as we'll hear in my conversation with him taped last Friday. Director Hawk, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me, Craig. I have been in this office for just over 2 months now. Pretty new to the office in this role, but not new to the office in general. I've been in this office for just going on 11 years now.
If I were to ask you, Director, what your role is, what would you tell me?
As Executive Director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, we look to bridge the two governments, state government and tribal government, work on different issues that, let's say, the tribal nation might be having, you know, make sure that our state agencies are aware of that. Let them offer solutions when applicable, you know. So our role mainly is to make sure that the two governments are communicating, making sure that we're working through issues and make sure there's no arguments on each side. And there's going to be good arguments and bad arguments, but we make sure that they're still communicating and make sure that we address the issue.
Tell me about yourself. What's your journey? You grew up, you told me, on the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe Reservation in South Dakota.
Yep, I grew up there. I went to the University of South Dakota, and I met my wife at college there, and we decided to move to Bismarck, North Dakota after college. And so in 2000, we moved here and looked for a job, and I ended up working at Prairie Nights Casino for a year. Then I applied for United Tribes Technical College. So I worked there for 11 years in different roles, did everything from fundraising to grant writing and some other grant management stuff. But my background was mostly health. I was trained in healthcare administration. I was asked to run their wellness center on the University of United Tribes Technical College campus, and so I ran that for just over a year. The commissioner of the Indian Affairs at that time asked if I would take on a role for being a healthcare liaison for the state of North Dakota, and so that's kind of how I ended up in the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission. This was back in 2013, so we were working on different healthcare topics with the Department of Health and Department of Human Services at times. So through that, you know, you learn all the other topics and other issues that our tribes deal with. So we were working a lot with the different state agencies to help alleviate any questions, or if there's new programs that a state government is implementing, then we would make sure that the tribes are included in that. It's been a little bit of a journey, you know, through my time here. We make sure that through the legislative process, there's a lot of hearings and policy discussions. And so we want to make sure that our tribes are thought about when bills are being created. You know, some bills could impact the tribe directly, but a lot of times they're indirectly impacting a tribal nation. And so we have to make sure that those legislators understand that. And so we communicate that during that time. So that's been a pretty big role in our office. You know, obviously that's not the only thing that we do. And for us being part of the executive branch of state government, we still try to work with the judicial branch. We still work with the legislative branch. So we're communicating with the different branches of state government, still trying to make sure that our tribal governments are included in all that.
So. Director, I've witnessed in Wyoming times when the state had interests and the tribe had interests, and they weren't necessarily the same. And I watched people who were liaisons in your position as a state government employee struggle with, how do I manage that? How do I navigate that? What are your thoughts about representing kind of both sides here for many issues, some really complex?
I think a big piece of it is having good partners. So when we're working on certain issues, you know, we make sure that we bring in the professionals that are working in that area of that issue. You know, this could be a nonprofit, it could be for-profit corporation, whatever the issue is. But we just want to make sure that we have the right information and make sure we share that with the tribal governments and also state agency leaders too. When we bring all that together, then we make sure we have a clear picture of how to move forward. And so by having the information information available to you, then that's when you can make a sound decision. So that's kind of been our role.
You have historically, the state and the tribes, many, many significant challenges, and some are still ongoing today. What would you tell me your top priority is relative to what needs the most focus now?
I think for our tribal communities, you know, a lot of times we're tasked with getting jobs to our tribal communities, you know, when we're still addressing high rates of unemployment. And so our tribal governments have really been working towards, you know, having more opportunities for their tribal members to work. And so we're looking at programs like apprenticeship programs through the unions. We're looking at other workforce development type programming through our tribal college system to get, you know, jobs that are, that will not, you know, you can get a degree in a year or two and be ready for the workforce. So there's a lot of issues on that part of it, but, you know, for the tribes, you know, we're trying to set the table for the younger generation to come and, you know, step right into these opportunities and have them available. When we're talking about preparing a workforce, you know, there's obviously other issues that we have to deal with. There's other, you know, when you're talking about healthcare and other pieces, that housing, there's all these other variables that we have to look at. And so we can't just fix one thing and expect it to work for all tribal nations. We have to take a look at each tribal nation separately and figure out what their assets are, what issues they're having, and then address them directly. So it takes a lot of communication. It takes a lot of meetings and kind of figuring out, you know, the best route. As you see our tribal nations, we're starting to develop 5-year, 10-year, 15-year plans on how to address different issues in their economy of their tribe. But we still want to make sure that, you know, they have that voice. We offer them the opportunities to meet with our state leaders and set different places for communication to happen. And so that, you know, that could be our government-to-government conference that we have, or it could be a meeting with legislators that we try to do before session. These are just tools that we use to kind of get the ball rolling on a lot of communication.
When you have those communications, Director, are there certain issues that maybe always come to the forefront for legislators and others who just didn't know something about the tribes that you bring to them? What is it that the legislators sometimes don't realize about the tribes in North Dakota and the work of your office?
You know, I've worked a lot in the healthcare field, just my time here in the office. And so we get a lot of questions about access to healthcare and how our tribal members on and off reservation, how does that look? So we do have to re-educate on the limitations of the healthcare system that the tribal members have as opposed to those that live off reservation. That's one piece. I know when we're talking about how do we improve the workforce and the economy of each tribe, it's taking time. But I know our tribes are really getting more sophisticated on how they're addressing different, diversifying their economy. And so they're not putting all their eggs into one basket. And so they're looking at how to build up the whole economy instead of just one piece. And so, you know, historically, you know, a lot of the revenue has been casinos in each of the tribal communities. Now they're looking at other pieces of it. You know, it could be that's just one part to bring people to their community. So now they have other things like interpretive centers to teach their culture and the tourism side. So that's kind of been a big piece that we've been looking at with each tribe to enhance that and work with the Department of Commerce on their tourism plans. So there's a lot of collaboration on different pieces that we look to bridge and make better and to make sure our tribes are included, though. And that's kind of our main thing. Is
enjoying our conversation with Brad Hawk. He's the executive director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission. He's visiting with us today from his office in Bismarck. Director, talk to me about education for members of tribes. Historically, at least in my state, there have been issues relative to equitable and fair education and even what education means. Are those issues on your plate too?
Yeah, there's things that we're working on. Education is a big piece of addressing a lot of our issues in our tribal communities. If you think about how many tribal colleges there are in the state, you know, we have 5 tribal colleges here locally, and we're blessed to have that because each of those tribal communities can address specific needs that they have. But, you know, we're making sure that they're communicating and and connected with their high school system, because, you know, when we're talking about preparing for a workforce, you know, that they're a big piece of it too. So a lot of the work that we're talking about with the school system, making sure that Department of Public Instruction is working with each tribal community. And I know we have a good connection there. There's been some legislation in the past that we worked on to incorporate the history of our tribal nations into the school system. So there's different pieces of what our office can help with. We know that education is critical to address a lot of our need.
I know too, the preservation of language and cultural heritage is vital to tribes. How does that intersect well with our public education system today in North Dakota? And I guess, is there more work to do there?
You know, there has been great strides taken in our different tribal communities to preserve their language. I know Standing Rock has a language immersion program that teaches kids, you know, Head Start through elementary school. And so they want to build up some of their speakers in as kids and incorporate that into adulthood. They have big plans for doing that through a lot of their community buildings and community outreach that they do. I know MHA has taken the initiative through their tribal college to ensure language is being preserved. I think I heard that Turtle Mountain is doing some stuff with Rosetta Stone to teaching of their language through that program. So there's different things that are happening, you know, by having this mechanism through the tribal colleges and the school system. There is opportunity to, you know, make sure that the language and traditions are preserved and communicated. But that's different if you live off a reservation. So those are things that, you know, we're talking with some of the big school systems on how they incorporate different traditional teachings in the school systems off reservation. And so we do work with, let's just say, Bismarck Public Schools to make sure that their Indian education programs are connected with our tribal members going to school locally. And so there's some good things happening.
The recent redistricting lawsuit, I'm sure you're very familiar with, I think highlighted the importance of tribal representation in the legislature. How did you see the Office of the Indian Affairs Commission playing a role then and now in ensuring fair representation and engagement of tribal nations in state governance?
Well, I think, you know, we just want to make sure that we abide by what the court ruling was and make sure that those meetings were happening. You know, we were at the table when we were talking about different maps and how that was going to look. Obviously, it's really complex when you're talking about census data and information about population. Our tribal communities have been underrepresented through the census, so that can be another wrench into a lot of things. But that's a tool that's been used for years, and so that's why we encourage, you know, that process to be enhanced in our tribal community, because that's where a lot of these decisions get made. So, but for us, you know, we just want to make sure that the legislative council and legislators that we're all at the table. And so that was kind of a lot of our meetings behind doors, is to make sure that, you know, everybody's talking the same language, making sure we're clear about, you know, abiding by that court ruling.
Given, Director, the diverse cultures and histories and needs of the five tribal nations in North Dakota, is it difficult or is it manageable for you to be inclusive and representative of all the tribes?
Well, for our office, you know, we get requests to be part of a lot of meetings, mainly from the perspective that we have, you know, access to different groups and we talk to a lot of different folks, you know, within state government. But, you know, for us, we really pushed for our tribal members to be involved in a lot of our committees, because they're the ones in those communities and making decisions in their communities. So we really try to make sure that we are there to help bridge the gap, but we still want the voice of the tribal people to come directly from each tribe.
We've talked a little bit about opportunities that are ahead for the tribes. What's the biggest hurdle that this state needs to overcome, that your tribes that you work with need to overcome?
I think, you know, we've really struggled with job opportunities and having access to different industries. And you know, I talked about it earlier, how we're looking to expand on different areas and incorporate new opportunities. You know, the state of North Dakota is really pushing for new industry, new work in different parts of industry. It could be energy development. It could be, it could be agricultural. I mean, we're looking at a lot of these different pieces that really haven't been the forefront for our tribal communities, and trying to work on how can we get our tribes to move into that or expand what they're doing. So that's some of the work that we're doing through the office. And we really want to make sure that our tribes are at the table a lot of times. And so when a new opportunity comes up, we make sure we get the right people to the table, and a lot of those new potential partners that are looking to come to North Dakota, they reach out to our office to see if there's an opportunity with our tribal nations, and so we make those connections.
Director, this is a hard question, but I want to ask it of you. There have been news accounts of racist incidents on high school basketball courts, and I don't understand all of the details. I'm not sure that you do, but what comes to your mind when you see those stories?
Well, from a personal perspective, I've seen it, and I do know that it happens, and a lot of it is just lack of education in our tribal communities, and so there is opportunities, there's efforts to provide that education about a tribal nation. I do hear it as being a sports lover and being part of just watching basketball or football or whatever sport it is, it's really a tough issue. And I know people don't want to talk about racism. People don't think that it's happening. But being a person of color, I grew up and noticed things differently. And so we can't keep dancing around it. We got to understand that it is happening. But I think education is key to addressing it. So.
One of the things I realized growing up in Riverton, Wyoming, and we were surrounded by the Wind River Indian Reservation. They were our neighbors. They lived just a few miles from us. I didn't take the time, number one, I'm embarrassed to say when I was younger, to understand who they were, who my friends were, what their heritage was. Do you see that as an issue here too in North Dakota, that our friends and neighbors oftentimes really don't know that much about one another?
It is. I mean, it's part of it. And I think, there are efforts to address that. And so, but when we're talking, let's just say the school system, when we're educating about our tribal nations through North Dakota history, try to educate through that. That's at one point of time, through an education process. If we were really wanting to learn about our tribal nations, it would have to be more than one time. And so there are resources that are available through the Department of Public Instruction for essential understandings. And as we're looking to learn more about a tribal nation, I mean, there is interviews that are done with tribal leaders. There's stuff that we're working on through the North Dakota Historical Society on preserving some of that tradition and language and even some of our past leaders. There's things that are available for people to learn more about our tribal population. But, our office really looks at, even some of our efforts that we do through Native American Heritage Month. I mean, that's usually a month where you'll see a lot more information about our tribal communities and things that have happened in the past. But a lot of times you don't hear about the good things happening either, And so that's kind of been things that we've promoted through our conference that we have every year, to talk about what are the good things happening in our tribal communities, and let's showcase that. So,
Governor Burgum praised your ability to work through complex issues when he appointed you to your position. What has been the most complex issue, the biggest struggle that you've had in working through an issue in your position?
I think, working on different agreements that we're talking about between the state and the tribal government, that's usually really complex, because then you're talking about, how does two different governments coincide, and making sure that they listen to the you know, their constitutions, their what they believe in through their state laws or tribal law. And so agreements are usually the most complex because, you know, obviously there's going to be issues that are going to test that agreement. And so, you know, there could be legal involved. There's other pieces of jurisdiction that kind of get tied in sometimes. But, you know, In the big scheme of things, you know, we're just trying to make things better for all citizens in North Dakota, and that includes our tribal nations. So a lot of big picture thing, you know, we want to make sure that these agreements happen, but we also want the tribes to be comfortable to develop these agreements in their best interest also. So,
Director, if people want to learn more about what you do and what the commission does, how can they do that?
Well, we have information on our website. We have a social media feed, and a lot of our information could be found on our website. We do have Indian Affairs Commission meetings that happen quarterly, and people can view online. And, you know, we talk about new opportunities there. We talk about, you know, issues that we've been working on for some time, but it's a good mix of, you know, both. So. We try to post as much as we can on our social media, and as we get fully staffed, we'll probably enhance that even more. So,
Brad Hawk, he's the Executive Director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission. Director, it's been a pleasure to visit with you.
Yep, thank you for having me.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
You're listening to Prairie Public right now, so I bet you're a bit of a news junkie, right? But do you also like music? Well, I bet you do. Prairie Public is the place for that too. Did you know that we have a guy named Mike Olson who spins adult album alternative music during the week?
And there goes the last DJ.
He's got an endless library, limitless musical knowledge, and a clever way of handcrafting sets of songs. You can listen to Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream on an app or a smart speaker pretty much anywhere, and on an HD radio anywhere in the region. Check out Mike Olson on Prairie Public weekdays from 9 a.m. to 10 and noon to 6 p.m.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. On August 21st of 2017, I had a once-in-a-lifetime experience of watching a total solar eclipse with an astronaut, a solar physicist, an astronomer, and the widow of a space shuttle commander, and of course, also with friends and my family. I'll never forget it. Well, coming on April 8th, just 2 weeks from today, much of our country will get to experience the same thing I did. Here in Fargo, around 2 p.m., we'll experience about a 60% partial solar eclipse. We'll have more in the coming days about the solar eclipse on Prairie Public, but today we have an excerpt from Living on Earth. Cosmetologist Roberto Trotta, the author of Starborn, How the Stars Made Us and Who Would We Be Without Them, joins host Jenny Doring to describe how our ancestors reacted to this strange, otherworldly phenomenon and how you, too, can safely witness it.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Ainsley O'Neill.
And I'm Jenny Doring. On April 8th, 2024, millions across North America will have the rare opportunity to experience a total solar eclipse when the moon briefly blocks out the sun. But in order to really take it in, you have to be in just the right place within the path of totality. And even there, the total solar eclipse lasts just a few precious minutes. NASA has an Eclipse Explorer website where you can see its path. But we turn now to an expert who can tell us about how our ancestors reacted to this strange, otherworldly phenomenon. We're joined now by cosmologist Roberto Trotta, the author of Starborn, How the Stars Made Us and Who We Would Be Without Them. Welcome back to the show, Roberto.
Great. It's fantastic to be back. Thank you.
So let's start with a passage from your book that talks about your experience witnessing a total solar eclipse. Let's turn to page 34 and the section titled A Jolt of Awe.
Then it happens. The sun slides fully behind the dark disk. The stillness of a moment beyond time is broken by our exclamations, soon joined by the cheers and shouts of the crowds at the ranch down below us. It's impossible to keep it in. The wonder has to be voiced. We yell, we scream, we bawl, we howl, we regress to a more primitive state. Through cracks in the sky, the stars appear as if eager to witness the impending doom. The corona, the outer part of the sun's atmosphere, hundreds of times hotter than its surface yet normally invisible, radiates around the unnatural black hole in the sky. It's a ring of fire where the sun used to be, fierce, ominous. I know that the appearance of the corona doesn't change in a matter of minutes, yet I find it hard to shake off the impression that it is vibrating with cold energy. I know the totality will last 1 minute and 58 seconds, yet time feels expanded. What if the sun never reappears? I am standing in the moon's shadow, and the beam of darkness connects me to the stars. I touch my cheek, and my hand comes away damp.
Thank you. What you're describing sounds like such a profound experience.
It was. It was profoundly moving and primordial in a way that I did not expect. As a scientist, I knew exactly what I was witnessing, but in the moment, it is as if rationality almost flies out of the window. This black hole in the sky really feels so unnatural, so unlike anything I've ever witnessed before. And when you're actually in the moon's shadow, you feel, you know, transported into a different time, into a different way of being almost. And all of these legends and myth, all of this ancestral fear of eclipses grips you again. So it's wonderful and terrifying at the same time.
And it's sort of a coincidence, I understand. And you write in your book that, you know, we happen to be able to see total solar eclipses, and it may not always be that way on the Earth when we look really far into the future. So what is this coincidence that you write about?
Indeed, it's a strange cosmic coincidence that makes it so that while the sun is much bigger than the moon, it is also so much further away. In fact, about 400 times as further away as the moon, but the moon is almost exactly 400 times smaller than the sun. And so when they line up just right, the moon covers the sun fully, and we are treated to this wonderful phenomenon, this total solar eclipse. But this will not always be so, because the moon is receding, is moving away from the Earth. And so there will be a day in a few hundreds of millions of years where the moon will have moved further away than it is now, and sufficiently so that the disk of the moon will not cover the disk of the sun anymore, and total solar eclipses will become impossible. So we've got only a few hundred million years left to witness this amazing cosmic phenomenon before it's too late.
Well, we're lucky to be at this time in history when we can experience it. And total solar eclipses have been occurring at least as long as humans have existed. How have past civilizations reacted to these phenomena?
In the past, total solar eclipses were so feared because they were mostly impossible to predict. And so the reaction was one of great terror, and oftentimes in past civilizations, people would engage in rituals and chants and dances in order to scare away whatever they thought was trying to eat up the sun or destroy the sun. Some civilizations saw dragons or monsters trying to eat the sun from the sky. Some others, like the Aztec, for example, would throw fiery arrows towards the sun in an attempt to give it back its life force and its fire to fight off this cosmic enemy. And so in general, people were absolutely scared to their death by this event, and they had attempted everything they could, rituals, magic, prayers, invocation, in order to get the life force of the sun back into its rightful place.
And I think in your book, you talk about how this influenced who was in charge, who was ruling at various times. Can you describe some of that for us?
Absolutely. Many of the kings and emperors of the past claimed that their power was divinely inspired and oftentimes descended directly from a deity that was identified with the sun. There was, for example, the case for the pharaohs in Egypt and others. Even Louis XIV in France was named the Sun King for a reason, because he felt that he was a representative of the force of the sun on Earth, even, you know, in historical times. But perhaps no other civilization was more attentive to ward off the dangers that the disappearance of the sun could bring about for the empire than the Assyrians. And the Assyrians, who lived in Mesopotamia over 3,000 years ago, they had a very special way of seeing off this cosmic danger to their king. Because, of course, when the sun disappeared from the sky, that was seen as ominous and as a bad omen for the king. And so what the Assyrians did, they would, when a solar eclipse was, if not expected, but at least possible, they were able to predict when a solar eclipse could potentially happen, even though they could not exactly predict when that would for certain happen. So when a solar eclipse was possible, they would instate, enthrone a substitute king, a puppet of sorts, somebody taken from the populace or perhaps a prisoner, somebody who would for a period of time become in all effects the king, and they would swear a special oath that they would take upon themselves all the terrestrial and celestial portents in order to see off the danger. And once the solar eclipse had passed and the substitute king was no longer needed, he would be executed and the old king reinstated. So in that respect, one could say that the solar eclipse was always a bad omen for the substitute king.
Yeah, not so great to be that person who's instated, even though it sounds great, right? Instated as king for a while. Doesn't end well.
No. It always ended badly for the substitute king.
So humans have noticed and been awed by solar eclipses for thousands of years. But more recently, how has science benefited from studying them?
Solar eclipses have been really important for many reasons, but particularly because at the beginning of the 20th century, a famous solar eclipse, the one in 1919, allowed astronomer Arthur Eddington to prove Albert Einstein right. Einstein had famously predicted, using his newly discovered theory of general relativity, that the position of stars around the sun would appear shifted with respect to their usual position by the bending of space-time. And he made a very specific prediction of the amount of bending, the angle of displacement of those stars around the sun. But of course, that was impossible to measure during the day because we don't see stars during the day around the sun. So you need a solar eclipse. And when the solar eclipse in 1919 came around, Eddington and others sailed from the United Kingdom to various places in the world to measure the prediction that Einstein had made. And they found him correct. And so that essentially propelled Einstein overnight into scientific stardom. So that was one of the ways in which solar eclipses have been used by science to test the fundamental nature of space-time.
Now, Roberto, we heard that passage from you, and I understand that you and your family were dead set on getting to that total solar eclipse a few years back. It was kind of a struggle. You were carrying a baby, hiking up a hill to get to the perfect spot. Why was it so important to you as a cosmologist and as a human to witness a total solar eclipse?
Yes, it was a bit of a struggle, and we traveled thousands of miles, and we hired an RV to get to the perfect spot, and then we hiked up that hill, and in the end, we managed, and it was all worth it because, you know, I'd never seen one before. I tried to see a total solar eclipse in 1999 in southern Germany, but the sky had been clouded. And it hadn't been a success. I didn't feel much. It wasn't really impressive. And I kept hearing about all of these life-changing experiences people were having, experiencing a total solar eclipse. And to me, it was really important to have that experience, the lived experience of the solar eclipse, partially because I wanted to reconnect to what the sky meant for our ancestors. We talked earlier about how solar eclipses were really terrifying for people in the past. And I wanted to understand how that cosmic connection of ours, which is nowadays largely lost, we experience the sky through screens most of the time. We look at pictures of the sky, which are wonderful, wonderful opportunities, but we've lost the lived connection. And I wanted to recapture some of that. And it was very important to me to do it with my family, with my wife and my two young children, because I felt this was a almost unique lifetime experience to have had that connection and to stand in the shadow of the moon and to feel what you feel. It's not just the shadow, it's also the cold air swirling around, the color changing, the nature changing around you. It's a special moment. It's a special moment.
So that experience for you was back in 2017, which was when what was called the Great American Eclipse came to North America, because I believe it went coast to coast. It covered much of the U.S. And now there's another total solar eclipse coming up on April 8th, that will cross much of North America. What recommendations do you have for people who want to view this eclipse?
Yes, this eclipse is going to be spectacular. And if you are close to the center of the path of totality, you will be able to experience it for up to 4 minutes, 30 seconds almost, which is far longer than I've experienced it. So that's a far longer lasting eclipse if you are in the right place. And so my top recommendation is try and get as close as you can to the central line of the path of totality, because that's where the experience will be the best and will last the longest. It's very, very important that you are within the path of totality, which is the region where the sun is completely covered by the disk of the moon. If you are even a little bit outside, even if the disk of the sun is 99% covered, which seems like a lot, you're going to miss out. It's not going to be the same experience at all. There's still going to be enough light to ruin the best of the show. You won't be able to see the corona, which is the flaring rings of fire, if you like, around the sun. You won't be able to see stars during the day, which is incredible. And you won't get the full change of colors around you as the shadow of the moon travels over you at over 2,000 miles per hour. You won't get any of that. It will still be spectacular, but really, if you can make the effort of going that extra mile and get yourself inside, because inside the actual shadow, all of those things happen. The equally important piece of advice is never, ever, ever look at the sun directly before it's covered by the moon without special eclipse glasses, because your eyesight will be damaged very, very quickly if you try and do that. So never look directly at the sun until totality occurs, until it's completely eclipsed by the moon, at which point rip off those glasses, because the real spectacle is then, you know, with your naked eye, and the glasses are not only not needed, they are in the way. So take them off and look at this amazing spectacle while it lasts.
Wow. Okay. I will remember that for sure. Do not look directly at the sun until you're sure that it's completely covered. And this corona of the sun that you mentioned, so that must be safe to look at with your naked eye?
Yes, yes. Once the sun is fully covered, then yes. And indeed, that's one of the most incredible sights, because it's this flaring of rays all around the sun that extend quite a bit outside the sun. They're always there. We can't see them usually because the light itself of the sun covers it up. So we don't see it under normal conditions. But this is the hotter part of the solar atmosphere flaring out. And it's very spectacular because there's this amazing contrast between the pitch blackness of the disk of the moon in the center and the brilliant white of the corona, which is entirely safe to look at with your naked eyes. And that's something you really want to witness. Also, look around, look at the stars you see in the skies. If there's any planets visible, they will show up as well. It's really amazing.
Wow, I can't wait. So a total solar eclipse can last from just 10 seconds to around 7 minutes. And that sounds like a really short time for an event that happens only every 100 years or so from a given location.
But it's not. Actually, my eclipse, the one that I witnessed, only lasted a minute 58 seconds. And that sounds even less. Certainly, it is less than the one that's coming up, which will last up to 4 minutes and 27 seconds. But it's actually quite a long time, because while you are in the shadow, time plays tricks on you. Time stretches. The flow is almost stopped. And it feels like you are almost entering a different flow of time. So I experienced it for less than 2 minutes, and it felt a much longer time frame, actually. So to experience it for anything around 4 minutes this time must be incredible, because, you know, when you look at this black hole in the sky and you start wondering, will it ever move on? Will the moon ever give us back the sun? And it gets cold quite quickly as well. You know, the temperature drops quite sensibly while you are in the shadow. It's really an experience that changes your perception of time. So, no, 4 minutes is plenty to enjoy it and to get a really wonderful sense of what it feels like.
Sounds like one of those experiences where all of your senses can be heightened and you can just feel really purely in that moment.
Yes. And my piece of advice is don't get obsessed with capturing the eclipse with your phone, with your camera, because the reality is there's plenty of great pictures of the eclipse everywhere online. You can download any number of them, and chances are they're going to be better than yours. But your multisensorial experience is not just the sight. It's also, if you're in nature, you will hear nature calm down. It's the sensation of the shadow of the moon being cold. All of this you cannot capture on your camera. If you're fiddling with your phone, if you're fiddling with your camera most of the time to try to capture the actual eclipse, you're going to miss out on actually experiencing what is going on all around you. So my advice is to focus, to be in the moment, And so try to savor it and do not try to live it through screens, because you will be missing some of the experience.
Roberto Trotta is a cosmologist and author of Starborn, How the Stars Made Us and Who We Would Be Without Them. Thank you so much, Roberto.
Thank you. It's been a huge pleasure being with you.
Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from you, our listeners, and from the University of Massachusetts Boston, in association with its School for the Environment, developing the next generation of environmental leaders, and from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration in solving the world's most pressing environmental problems.
PRX.
Juilliard's dance program started in 1951 and is known for pushing boundaries. Now it's going even further because of Alicia Grafmack, the first Black person and youngest person to be the dance division's dean and director.
I have always been sort of the unicorn or the standout.
How Juilliard is changing on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
Beyond birding, fishing, walking, and of course, after today's blizzard, there will be many enjoyable ways for us to connect with nature. The spring landscape will soon bloom, inviting residents to explore and appreciate the natural beauty of North Dakota, as we'll hear in this Natural North Dakota.
It seems that every year when spring comes around, we're ready to go outdoors. Nature has much to offer, but all too often summer arrives, and we realize that we did not get out to enjoy the spring like we had hoped. From now until around Memorial Day is great bird watching. The sights and sounds of geese and other waterfowl have already begun in some areas. And of course, other migratory birds will be showing up soon, sporting their bright colored breeding plumage. Consider visiting a nearby National Wildlife Refuge. Most, if not all of them, provide both auto and hiking trails to observe nature. The mating season for sharp-tailed grouse is on, or will start soon. If you've not watched the sharp-tailed grouse on their dancing grounds, you owe it to yourself to see them at least once. You can cruise the grasslands and stop occasionally to listen for sounds similar to that of someone rapidly blowing air over the top of a pop bottle, a sure sign that males are strutting their stuff on the dance floor. Then try to get closer for a better look, but be careful not to spook them. Better yet, check out a local National Wildlife Refuge. Some refuges provide blinds for observing the grouse. We often dismiss the little birds flitting around the trees and shrubs near our homes as sparrows. But sometime soon, perhaps April and May, warblers will be migrating through our area. These sparrow-sized birds are quite colorful, and the best time to see them is before the trees and shrubs become fully leafed out. Going fishing is a common activity, and simply going for a walk in a park, the woods, or over the prairie can be a great way to connect with nature. You might even consider going out to look for deer sheds. Deer shed their antlers over the winter, and it's around this time of year, when on a walk in the woods or across the grassland, one can find those antlers lying on the ground. And of course, there's always lots of other things to see, hear, smell, and touch. When was the last time you saw a passflower or Nuttall's violet blooming on the prairie? Or fall Solomon seal or nodding trillium flowering in the woodlands? The opportunities and experiences are endless. Make a point to taking the time to get out and enjoy nature this spring. Whatever you choose, spring outings are a great way to enjoy a little natural North Dakota. So get out and enjoy. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
That was a Natural North Dakota essay from biologist Chuck Lura. Chuck was a longtime biology professor at Dakota College at Bottineau, and in retirement, he continues to share his Natural North Dakota essays for our Prairie Public audience. Dakota Datebook is ahead.
Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 4 is about sense of humor. It states, Native people have a rich history of shared sense of humor that includes teaching stories involving Iktomi, Memegwisi, and Nanaboju. These stories and this unique sense of humor continue to support our resiliency and cohesiveness. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Dr. Twyla Baker, enrolled member of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, in part two of We Laugh So We Don't Cry.
I think about some of my colleagues and my friends, professionals, who have to deal with a death or a loss or any other type of hardship. And the next moment, they're having to deal with budgets, and they're having to deal with, you know, strategic plans, or they're having to deal with all this other stuff. You know, they're just trying to live life while they're carrying this burden of grief. So we like to joke. We like to laugh. We like to tease. And we'll try to lift some of that burden and help carry it for each other. So, and I think about my, some of my other relatives who are incredibly funny and who have taken it to the next level. They've put it onto social media. They start using Native humor as a means to tell our story and to teach lessons, of course, still. And to just express themselves artistically, too. I mean, that's completely valid. The sense of humor is to me, it's second to none. I mean, we have a lot of inside jokes, too. And I think there's this sense sometimes, and I don't want to get too terribly pan-Indian or anything like that, but I've heard people say that for an outsider coming into the Indian community, if people are being terribly polite to you, then they probably don't like you. But if they're teasing you, then you've been accepted and they like you. So, because they know you can take it and you can, you know, probably tease back.
I'm Charla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us, and remember, we love to hear comments from our listeners and would love to hear from you. If you have comments or questions about Main Street or have ideas for guests that you would like to hear from, send them our way via email to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from Bill Peterson. He's the director of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. He'll share with us he and his staff's insights and work on preserving North Dakota's heritage. We hope that you can join us again tomorrow on Main Street.